Oliver was receiving many invitations to other houses. This had become something of a tradition with our other summer residents as well. My father always wanted them to feel free to talk their books and expertise around town. He also believed that scholars should learn how to speak to the layman, which is why he always had lawyers, doctors, businessmen over for meals. Everyone in Italy has read Dante, Homer, and Virgil, he'd say. Doesn't matter whom you're talking to, so long as you Dante and Homer them first. Virgil is a must. Leopardi comes next, and then feel free to dazzle them with everything you've got. Ceylon, celery, salami, who cares? This also had the advantage of allowing all of our summer residents to perfect their Italian, one of the requirements of the residency. Having them on the dinner circuit around B also had another benefit. It relieved us from having them at our table every single night of the week. But Oliver's invitations had become vertiginous. Chiara and her sister wanted him at least twice a week. A cartoonist from Brussels who rented a villa all summer long wanted him for his exclusive Sunday, Supers, to which writers and scholars from the environs were always invited. Then the Moreschis, from three villas down, the Malaspinas from N, and the occasional acquaintance struck up at one of the bars in the Piazzetta, or at La Danzig. All of this to say nothing of his poker and bridge playing at night, which flourished by means totally unknown to us. His life, like his papers, even when it gave every impression of being chaotic, was always meticulously compartmentalized. Sometimes he skipped dinner altogether and would simply tell Mafalda, "Esco, I'm going out." His esco, I realized soon enough, was just another version of later. A summary and unconditional goodbye spoken not as you were leaving, but after you were out the door. You said it with your back to those you were leaving behind. I felt sorry for those on the receiving end who wished to appeal, to plead. Not knowing whether he'd show up at the dinner table was torture, but bearable. Not daring to ask whether he'd be there was the real ordeal. Having my heart jump when I suddenly heard his voice or saw him seated at his seat when I'd almost given up hoping that he'd be among us tonight, eventually blossomed like a poisoned flower. Seeing him and thinking he'd join us for dinner tonight only to hear his peremptory esco taught me that there are certain wishes that must be clipped like wings off a thriving butterfly. I wanted him gone from our home so as to be done with him. I wanted him dead, too, so that if I couldn't stop thinking about him and worrying about when would be the next time I'd see him, at least his death would put an end to it. I wanted to kill him myself, even, so as to let him know how much his mere existence had come to bother me, how unbearable his ease with everything and everyone, taking all things in stride, his tireless, "I'm okay with this and that," his springing across the gate to the beach when everyone else opened the latch first, to say nothing of his bathing suits, his spot in paradise, his cheeky later, his lip-smacking love for apricot juice. If I didn't kill him, then I'd cripple him for life, so that he'd be with us in a wheelchair and never go back to the States. If he were in a wheelchair, I would always know where he was, and he'd be easy to find. I'd feel superior to him and become his master now that he was crippled. Then it hit me I could have killed myself instead, or hurt myself badly enough and let him know why I'd done it. If I hurt my face, I'd want him to look at me and wonder why. Why might anyone do this to himself until, years and years later, yes, later, he'd finally piece the puzzle together and beat his head against a wall. Sometimes it was Chiara who had to be eliminated. I knew what she was up to. At my age, her body was more than ready for him. More than mine, I wondered. She was after him, that much was clear, while all I really wanted was one night with him. Just one night. 1 hour, even. If only to determine whether I wanted him for another night after that. What I didn't realize was that wanting to test desire is nothing more than a ruse to get what we want without admitting that we want it. I dreaded to think how experienced he himself was. If he could make friends so easily within weeks of arriving here, you had only to think of what life at home was like. Just imagine letting him loose on an urban campus like Columbia's, where he taught. The thing with Chiara happened so easily it was past reckoning. With Chiara, he loved heading out into the deep on our twin-hulled rowboat for a gita. with him rowing while she lounged in the sun on one of the hulls, eventually removing her bra once they'd stopped and were far from shore. I was watching. I dreaded losing him to her, dreaded losing her to him too. Yet thinking of them together did not dismay me. It made me hard, even though I didn't know if what aroused me was her naked body lying in the sun, his next to hers, or both of theirs together. From where I stood against the balustrade along the garden overlooking the bluff, I would strain my eyes and finally catch sight of them lying in the sun next to one another, probably necking, she occasionally dropping a thigh on top of his, until minutes later he did the same. They hadn't removed their suits. I took comfort in that. But when later one night I saw them dancing, something told me that these were not the moves of people who'd stopped at heavy petting. Actually, I liked watching them dance together. Perhaps seeing him dance in this way was somewhat made me realize that he was taken now, that there was no reason to hope, and that this was a good thing. It would help my recovery. Perhaps thinking this way was already a sign that recovery was well underway. I had grazed the forbidden zone and been let off easily enough. But when my heart jolted the next morning when I saw him at our usual spot in the garden, I knew that wishing them my best and longing for recovery had nothing to do with what I still wanted from him. Did his heart jolt when he saw me walk into a room? I doubted it. Did he ignore me the way I ignored him that morning? On purpose? To draw me out? To protect himself? To show I was nothing to him? Or was he oblivious, the way sometimes the most perceptive individuals fail to pick up the most obvious cues because they're simply not paying attention, not tempted, not interested? When he and Kiara danced, I saw her slip her thigh between his legs. I'd seen them mock wrestle on the sand. When had it started? And how was it that I hadn't been there when it started? And why wasn't I told? Why wasn't I able to reconstruct the moment when they progressed from X to Y? Surely the signs were all around me. Why didn't I see them? I began thinking of nothing but what they might do together. I would have done anything to ruin every opportunity they had to be alone. I would have slandered one to the other, then used the reaction of one and report it back to the other. But I also wanted to see them do it. I wanted to be in on it. Have them owe me and make me their necessary accomplice, their go-between, the pawn that has become so vital to king and queen that it is now master of the board. I began to say nice things about each, pretending I had no inkling where things stood between them. He thought I was being coy. She said she could take care of herself. "Are you trying to fix us up?" she asked, derision crackling in her voice. "What's it to you anyway?" he asked. I described her naked body, which I'd seen 2 years before. I wanted him aroused. It didn't matter what he desired so long as he was aroused. I described him to her, too, because I wanted to see if her arousal took the same turn as mine, so that I might trace mine on hers and see which of the two was the genuine article. "You trying to make me like her?" "What would the harm be in that?" "No harm. Except I like to go it alone, if you don't mind." Took me a while to understand what I was really after. Not just to get him aroused in my presence or to make him need me, but in urging him to speak about her behind her back, I'd turn Kiara into the object of man-to-man gossip. It would allow us to warm up to one another through her, to bridge the gap between us by admitting we were drawn to the same woman. Perhaps I just wanted him to know I liked girls. "Look, it's very nice of you, and I appreciate it, but don't." His rebuke told me he wasn't going to play my game. It put me in my place. "No, he's the noble sort," I thought. "Not like me, insidious, sinister, and base," which pushed my agony and shame up a few notches. Now, over and above the shame of desiring him as Kiara did, I respected and feared him and hated him for making me hate myself. The morning after seeing them dance, I made no motions to go jogging with him. Neither did he. When I eventually brought up jogging, because the silence on the matter had become unbearable, he said he'd already gone. "You're a late riser these days." Clever, I thought. Indeed, for the past few mornings, I had become so used to finding him waiting for me that I'd grown bold and didn't worry too much about when I got up. That would teach me. The next morning, though, I wanted to swim with him, coming downstairs would have looked like a chastened response to a casual chiding. So I stayed in my room, just to prove a point. I heard him step lightly across the balcony, on tiptoes almost. He was avoiding me. I came downstairs much later. By then he'd already left to deliver his corrections and retrieve the latest pages from Signora Milani. We stopped talking. Even when we shared the same spot in the morning, talk was at best idle and stopgap. You couldn't even call it chit-chat. It didn't upset him. He probably hadn't given it another thought. How is it that some people go through hell trying to get close to you, while you haven't the haziest notion and don't even give them a thought when 2 weeks go by and you haven't so much as exchanged a single word between you? Did he have any idea? Should I let him know? The romance with Chiara started on the beach. Then he neglected tennis and took up bike rides with her and her friends in the late afternoons in the hill towns farther west along the coast. One day, when there was too many of them to go biking, Oliver turned to me and asked if I minded letting Mario borrow my bike since I wasn't using it. He threw me back to age 6. I shrugged my shoulders, meaning, go ahead. I couldn't care less. But no sooner had they left than I scrambled upstairs and began sobbing into my pillow. At night, sometimes we'd meet at Le Danzing. There was never any telling when Oliver would show up. He just bounded onto the scene and just as suddenly disappeared, sometimes alone, sometimes with others. When Chiara came to our home, as she'd been in the habit of doing ever since childhood, she would sit in the garden and stare out, basically waiting for him to show up. Then, when the minutes wore on and there was nothing much to say between us, she'd finally ask, "Say, Oliver?" "He went to see the translator," or, "He's in the library with my dad," or, "He's down somewhere at the beach." "Well, I'm leaving then. Tell him I came by." "It's over," I thought. Mafalda shook her head with a look of compassionate rebuke. "She's a baby. He's a university professor. Couldn't she have found someone her own age?" "Nobody asked you anything," snapped Chiara, who had overheard and was not about to be criticized by a cook. "Don't you talk to me that way or I'll split your face in two," said our Neapolitan cook, raising the palm of her hand in the air. "She's not 17 yet and she goes about having bare-breasted crushes. Thinks I haven't seen anything?" I could see Mafalda inspecting Oliver's sheets every morning, or comparing notes with Chiara's housemaid. No secret could escape this network of informed perpetuae. Housekeepers. I looked at Chiara. I knew she was in pain. Everyone suspected something was going on between them. In the afternoon, he'd sometimes say he was going to the shed by the garage to pick up one of the bikes and head to town. An hour and a half later, he'd be back. "The translator," he'd explain. "The translator," my father's voice would resound as he nursed an after-dinner cognac. "Traduttrice, my eye," Mafalda would intone. Sometimes we'd run into each other in town. Sitting at the cafe, where several of us would gather at night after the movies or before heading to the disco, I saw Chiara and Oliver walking out of a side alley together, talking. He was eating an ice cream while she was hanging on his free arm with both of hers. When had they found the time to become so intimate? Their conversation seemed serious. "What are you doing here?" he said when he spotted me. Banter was both how we took cover and tried to conceal we'd altogether stopped talking. A cheap ploy, I thought. "Hanging out. Isn't it past your bedtime?" "My father doesn't believe in bedtimes," I parried. Chiara was still deep in thought. She was avoiding my eyes. Had he told her the nice things I'd been saying about her? She seemed upset. Did she mind my sudden intrusion into their little world? I remembered her tone of voice on the morning when she'd lost it with Mafalda. A smirk hovered over her face. She was about to say something cruel. Never a bedtime in their house. No rules, no supervision, nothing. That's why he's such a well-behaved boy. Don't you see? Nothing to rebel against. "Is that true?" "I suppose," I answered, trying to make light of it before they went any further. "We all have our ways of rebelling." "We do?" he asked. "Name one," chimed in Chiara. "You wouldn't understand." "He reads Paul Celan," Oliver broke in, trying to change the subject, but also perhaps to come to my rescue and show, without quite seeming to, that he had not forgotten our previous conversation. Was he trying to rehabilitate me after that little jab about my late hours? Or was this the beginning of yet another joke at my expense? A steely neutral glance sat on his face. Ekie! She'd never heard of Paul Chelan. I shot him a complicit glance. He intercepted it, but there was no hint of mischief in his eyes when he finally returned my glance. Whose side was he on? A poet, he whispered as they started ambling out into the heart of the piazzetta. And he threw me a casual, later. I watched them look for an empty table at one of the adjoining cafes. My friends asked me if he was hitting on her. I don't know, I replied. Are they doing it then? Didn't know that either. I'd love to be in his shoes. Who wouldn't? But I was in heaven. That he hadn't forgotten our conversation about Chelan gave me a shot of tonic I hadn't experienced in many, many days. It spilled over everything I touched. Just a word, a gaze, and I was in heaven. To be happy like this maybe wasn't so difficult after all. All I had to do was find the source of happiness in me and not rely on others to supply it the next time. I remembered the scene in the Bible when Jacob asks Rachel for water, and on hearing her speak the words that were prophesied for him, throws up his hands to heaven and kisses the ground by the well. Me, Jewish. Chelan, Jewish. Oliver, Jewish. We were in a half-ghetto, half-oasis, in an otherwise cruel and unflinching world where fuddling around strangers suddenly stops, where we misread no one and no one misjudges us, where one person simply knows the other and knows him so thoroughly that to be taken away from such intimacy is galut, the Hebrew word for exile and dispersal. Was he my home, then? My homecoming? You are my homecoming. When I'm with you and we're well together, there's nothing more I want. You make me like who I am, who I become when you're with me, Oliver. If there is any truth in the world, it lies when I'm with you. And if I find the courage to speak my truth to you one day, remind me to light a candle in thanksgiving at every altar in Rome. It never occurred to me that if one word from him could make me so happy, another could just as easily crush me. That if I didn't want to be unhappy, I should learn to beware of such small joys as well. But on that same night, I used the heady elation of the moment to speak to Marzia. We danced past midnight. Then I walked her back by way of the shore. Then we stopped. I said I was tempted to take a quick swim, expecting she would hold me back. But she said she too loved swimming at night. Our clothes were off in a second. You're not with me because you're angry with Chiara. Why am I angry with Chiara? Because of him? I shook my head, feigning a puzzled look meant to show that I couldn't begin to guess where she'd fish such a notion from. She asked me to turn around and not stare while she used her sweater to towel her body dry. I pretended to sneak a clandestine glance, but was too obedient not to do as I was told. I didn't dare ask her not to look when I put my clothes on, but was glad she looked the other way. When we were no longer naked, I took her hand and kissed her on the palm, then kissed the space between her fingers, then her mouth. She was slow to kiss me back, but then she didn't want to stop. We were to meet at the same spot on the beach the following evening. I'd be there before her, I said. Just don't tell anyone, she said. I motioned that my mouth was zipped shut. We almost did it, I told both my father and Oliver the next morning as we were having breakfast. And why didn't you? Asked my father. Don't know. Better to have tried and failed. Oliver was half mocking and half comforting me with that oft-rehashed saw. All I had to do was find the courage to reach out and touch. She would have said yes, I said, partly to parry further criticism from either of them, but also to show that when it came to self-mockery, I could administer my own dose, thank you very much. I was showing off. Try again later, said Oliver. This is what people who were okay with themselves did. But I could also sense he was onto something and wasn't coming out with it. Perhaps because there was something mildly disquieting behind his fatuous, though well-intentioned, try again later. He was criticizing me, or making fun of me, or seeing through me. It stung me when he finally came out with it. Only someone who had completely figured me out would have said it. If not later, when? My father liked it. If not later, when? It echoed Rabbi Hillel's famous injunction. If not now, when? Oliver instantly tried to take back his stinging remark. I'd definitely try again. And again after that, came the watered-down version. But try again later was the veil he'd drawn over. If not later, when? I repeated his phrase as if it were a prophetic mantra meant to reflect how he lived his life and how I was attempting to live mine. By repeating this mantra that had come straight from his mouth, I might trip on a secret passageway to some nether truth that had hitherto eluded me. About me, about life, about others, about me with others. Try again later, were the last words I'd spoken to myself every night when I'd sworn to do something to bring Oliver closer to me. Try again later meant I haven't the courage now. Things weren't ready just yet. Where I'd find the will and courage to try again later, I didn't know. But resolving to do something rather than sit passively made me feel that I was already doing something, like reaping a profit on money I hadn't invested, much less earned yet. But I also knew that I was circling wagons around my life with try-again-laters, and that months, seasons, entire years, a lifetime could go by with nothing but Saint Try-Again-Later stamped on every day. Try-Again-Later worked for people like Oliver. If not later, when? Was my shibboleth. If not later, when? What if he had found me out and uncovered each and every one of my secrets with those four cutting words? I had to let him know I was totally indifferent to him. What sent me into a total tailspin was talking to him a few mornings later in the garden and finding, not only that he was turning a deaf ear to all of my blandishments on behalf of Kiara, but that I was on the totally wrong track. What do you mean, wrong track? I'm not interested. I didn't know if he meant not interested in discussing it or not interested in Kiara. Everyone's interested. Well, maybe. Not me. Still unclear. There was something at once dry, irked, and fussy in his voice. But I saw you two. What you saw was not your business to see. Anyway, I'm not playing this game with either her or you. He sucked on his cigarette and, looking back at me, gave me his usual menacing, chilly gaze that could cut and bore into your guts with arthroscopic accuracy. I shrugged my shoulders. Look, I'm sorry, and went back to my books. I'd overstepped my bounds again, and there was no getting out of it gracefully except by owning that I'd been terribly indiscreet. Maybe you should try, he threw in. I'd never heard him speak in that lambent tone before. Usually it was I who teetered on the fringes of propriety. She wouldn't want to have anything to do with me. Would you want her to? Where was this going? And why did I feel that a trap lay a few steps ahead? No, I replied gingerly, not realizing that my diffidence had made my no sound almost like a question. Are you sure? Had I, by any chance, convinced him that I wanted her all along? I looked up at him as though to return challenge for challenge. What would you know? I know you like her. You have no idea what I like, I snapped. No idea. I was trying to sound arch and mysterious, as though referring to a realm of human experience about which someone like him wouldn't have the slightest clue. But I only managed to sound peevish and hysterical. A less canny reader of the human soul would have seen in my persistent denials the terrified signs of a flustered admission about Kiara scrambling for cover. A more canny observer, however, would have considered it a lead-in to an entirely different truth. Push open the door at your own peril. Believe me, you don't want to hear this. Maybe you should go away now while there's still time. But I also knew that if he so much as showed signs of suspecting the truth, I'd make every effort to cast him adrift right away. If, however, he suspected nothing, then my flustered words would have left him marooned just the same. In the end, I was happier if he thought I wanted Kiara than if he pushed the issue farther and had me tripping all over myself. Speechless, I would have admitted things I hadn't mapped out for myself or didn't know I had it in me to admit. Speechless, I would have gotten to where my body longed to go, far sooner than with any bon mot prepared hours ahead of time. I would have blushed, and blushed because I had blushed, fuddled with words and ultimately broken down, and then where would I be? What would he say? Better break down now, I thought, than live another day juggling all my implausible resolutions to try again later. No, better he should never know. I could live with that. I could always, always live with that. It didn't even surprise me to see how easy it was to accept. And yet, out of the blue, a tender moment would erupt so suddenly between us that the words I longed to tell him would almost slip out of my mouth. Green bathing suit moments, I called them. Even after my color theory was entirely disproved and gave me no confidence to expect kindness on blue days or to watch out for red days. Music was an easy subject for us to discuss, especially when I was at the piano, or when he'd want me to play something in the manner of so-and-so. He liked my combinations of two, three, even four composers chiming in on the same piece, and then transcribed by me. One day Chiara started to hum a hit parade tune, and suddenly, because it was a windy day and no one was heading for the beach or even staying outdoors, our friends gathered around the piano in the living room as I improvised a Brahms variation on a Mozart rendition of the very same song. "How do you do this?" he asked me one morning while he lay in heaven. Sometimes the only way to understand an artist is to wear his shoes, to get inside him. Then everything else flows naturally. We talked about books again. I had seldom spoken to anyone about books except my father. Or we talked about music, about the pre-Socratic philosophers, about college in the U.S. Or there was Vimini. The first time she intruded on our mornings was precisely when I'd been playing a variation on Brahms' Last Variations on Handel. Her voice broke up the intense mid-morning heat. "What are you doing?" "Working," I replied. Oliver, who was lying flat on his stomach on the edge of the pool, looked up with the sweat pouring down between his shoulder blades. "Me too," he said when she turned and asked him the same question. "You were talking, not working." "Same thing. I wish I could work, but no one gives me any work." Oliver, who had never seen Vimini before, looked up to me, totally helpless, as though he didn't know the rules of this conversation. "Oliver, meet Vimini, literally our next-door neighbor." She offered him her hand, and he shook it. "Vimini and I have the same birthday, but she is 10 years old. Vimini is also a genius. Isn't it true you're a genius, Vimini?"
"So they say. But it seems to me that I may not be."
"Why is that?" Oliver inquired, trying not to sound too patronizing.
"It would be in rather bad taste for nature to have made me a genius."
Oliver looked more startled than ever.
"Come again?"
"He doesn't know, does he?" she was asking me in front of him. I shook my head. "They say I may not live long."
"Why do you say that?"
He had looked totally stunned. "How do you know?"
"Everyone knows. Because I have leukemia."
"But you're so beautiful. So healthy looking and so smart," he protested.
"As I said, bad joke."
Oliver, who was now kneeling on the grass, had literally dropped his book on the ground.
"Maybe you can come over one day and read to me," she said. "I'm really very nice, and you look very nice too. Well, goodbye."
She climbed over the wall.
"And sorry if I spooked you."
"Well..." You could almost watch her trying to withdraw the ill-chosen metaphor. If the music hadn't already brought us closer together at least for a few hours that day, Vimini's apparition did. We spoke about her all afternoon. I didn't have to look for anything to say. He did most of the talking and the asking. Oliver was mesmerized. For once, I wasn't speaking about myself. Soon they became friends. She was always up in the morning after he returned from his morning jog or swim, and together they would walk over to our gate and clamber down the stairs and head to one of the huge rocks where they sat and talked until it was time for breakfast. Never had I seen a friendship so beautiful or more intense. I was never jealous of it, and no one, certainly not I, dared come between them or eavesdrop on them.
I shall never forget how she would give him her hand once they'd opened the gate to the stairway leading to the rocks. She seldom ever ventured that far unless accompanied by someone older. When I think back to that summer, I can never sort the sequence of events. There are a few key scenes. Otherwise, all I remember are the repeat moments. The morning ritual before and after breakfast. Oliver lying on the grass or by the pool. I sitting at my table. Then the swim or the jog. Then his grabbing a bicycle and riding to see the translator in town. Lunch at the large, shaded dining table in the other garden. Or lunch indoors. Always a guest or two for lunch drudgery. The afternoon hours, splendid and lush with abundant sun and silence. Then there are the leftover scenes. My father always wondering what I did with my time. Why I was always alone. My mother urging me to make new friends if the old ones didn't interest me. But above all, to stop hanging around the house all the time. Books, 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 always books. And all these score books, both of them begging me to play more tennis, go dancing more often, get to know people, find out for myself why others are so necessary in life and not just foreign bodies to be sidled up to. Do crazy things if you must, they told me all the while, forever prying to unearth the mysterious, telltale signs of heartbreak which, in their clumsy, intrusive, devoted way, both would instantly wish to heal, as if I were a soldier who had strayed into their garden and needed his wound immediately stanched or else he'd die. You can always talk to me. I was once your age, my father used to say. The things you feel and think only you have felt, believe me, I've lived and suffered through all of them. And more than once. Some I've never gotten over, and others I'm as ignorant about as you are today. Yet I know almost every bend, every toll booth, every chamber in the human heart. There are other scenes. The postprandial silence. Some of us napping, some working, others reading. The whole world basking away in hushed semitones. Heavenly hours when voices from the world beyond our house would filter in so softly that I was sure I had drifted off. Then afternoon tennis. Shower and cocktails. Waiting for dinner. Guests again. Dinner. His second trip to the translator. Strolling into town and back late at night, sometimes alone, sometimes with friends. Then there are the exceptions. The stormy afternoon when we sat in the living room, listening to the music and to the hail pelting every window in the house. The lights would go out, the music would die, and all we had was each other's faces. An aunt twittering away with her dreadful years in St. Louis, Missouri, which she pronounced San Louis. Mother trailing the scent of Earl Grey tea, and in the background, all the way from the kitchen downstairs, the voices of Manfredi and Mafalda. Spare whispers of a couple bickering in loud hisses. In the rain, the lean, cloaked, hooded figure of the gardener doing battle with the elements. Always pulling up weeds, even in the rain. My father signaling with his arms from the living room window, "Go back," and Kise, "Go back." "That man gives me the creeps," my aunt would say. "That creep has a heart of gold," my father would say. But all of these hours were strained by fear, as if fear were a brooding specter, or a strange lost bird trapped in our little town, whose sooty wing flecked every living thing with a shadow that would never wash. I didn't know what I was afraid of, nor why I worried so much, nor why this thing that could so easily cause panic felt like hope sometimes, and, like hope in the darkest moments, brought such joy, unreal joy, joy with a noose tied around it. The thud my heart gave when I saw him unannounced both terrified and thrilled me. I was afraid when he showed up, afraid when he failed to, afraid when he looked at me, more frightened yet when he didn't. The agony wore me out in the end. And, on scalding afternoons, I'd simply give out and fall asleep on the living room sofa, and those still dreaming know exactly who was in the room, who had tiptoed in and out, who was standing there, who was looking at me and for how long, who was trying to pick out today's paper while making the least rustling sound, only to give up and look for tonight's film listings, whether they woke me or not. The fear never went away. I woke up to it, watched it turn to joy when I heard him shower in the morning and knew he'd be downstairs with us for breakfast, only to watch it curdle when, rather than have coffee, he would dash through the house and right away set to work in the garden. By noon, the agony of waiting to hear him say anything to me was more than I could bear. I knew that the sofa awaited me in an hour or so. It made me hate myself for feeling so hapless, so thoroughly invisible, so smitten, so callow. Just say something. Just touch me, Oliver. Look at me long enough and watch the tears well in my eyes. Knock at my door at night and see if I haven't already left it ajar for you. Walk inside. There's always room in my bed. What I feared most were the days when I didn't see him for stretches at a time. Entire afternoons and evenings sometimes without knowing where he'd been. I'd sometimes spot him crossing the piazzetta or talking to people I'd never seen there. But that didn't count. Because in the small piazzetta where people gathered around closing time, he seldom gave me a second look. Just a nod, which might have been intended less for me than for my father, whose son I happened to be. My parents, my father especially, couldn't have been happier with him. Oliver was working out better than most of our summer residents. He helped my father organize his papers, managed a good deal of his foreign correspondence, and was clearly coming along with his own book. What he did in his private life and his time was his business. If youth must canter, then who will do the galloping, was my father's clumsy adage. In our household, Oliver could do no wrong. Since my parents never paid any attention to his absences, I thought it was safer never to show that they caused me any anxiety. I mentioned his absence only when one of them wondered where he'd been. I would pretend to look as startled as they were. Oh, that's right. He's been gone so long. No idea. And I had to worry not to look too startled either, for that might ring false and alert them to what was eating at me. They'd know bad faith as soon as they spotted it. I was surprised they hadn't already. They'd always said I got too easily attached to people. This summer, though, I finally realized what they meant by being too easily attached. Obviously, it had happened before, and they must have already picked up on it when I was probably too young to have noticed anything myself. It had sent alarming ripples through their lives. They worried for me. I knew they were right to worry. I just hoped they'd never know how far things stood beyond their ordinary worries now. I knew they didn't suspect a thing, and it bothered me, though I wouldn't have wanted it otherwise. It told me that if I were no longer transparent and could disguise so much of my life, then I was finally safe from them. And from him. But at what price? And did I want to be so safe from anyone? There was no one to speak to. Whom could I tell? Mafalda? She'd leave the house. My aunt? She'd probably tell everyone. Marzia, Chiara, my friends? They'd desert me in a second. My cousins when they came? Never. My father held the most liberal views, but on this? Who else? Write to one of my teachers? See a doctor? Say I needed a shrink? Tell Oliver? Tell Oliver. There is no one else to tell, Oliver, so I'm afraid it's going to have to be you. One afternoon, when I knew that the house was totally empty, I went up to his room. I opened his closet and, as this was my room when there was no residence, pretended to be looking for something I'd left behind in one of the bottom drawers. I'd planned to rifle through his papers, but as soon as I opened his closet, I saw it. Hanging on a hook was this morning's red bathing suit, which he hadn't swum in, which is why it was hanging there and not drying on the balcony. I picked it up, never in my life having pried into anyone's personal belongings before. I brought the bathing suit to my face, then rubbed my face inside of it, as if I were trying to snuggle into it and lose myself inside its folds. So this is what he smells like when his body isn't covered in suntan lotion. This is what he smells like. This is what he smells like. I kept repeating to myself, looking inside the suit for something more personal yet than his smell, and then kissing every corner of it, almost wishing to find hair, anything to lick it, to put the whole bathing suit into my mouth. And if I could only steal it, keep it with me forever, never ever let Mafalda wash it, turn to it in the winter months at home and, on sniffing it, bring him back to life, as naked as he was with me at this very moment. On impulse, I removed my bathing suit and began to put his on. I knew what I wanted. I wanted it with the kind of intoxicated rapture that makes people take risks they never take, even with plenty of alcohol in their system. I wanted to come in his suit and leave evidence for him to find there. Which was when a crazier notion possessed me. I undid his bed, took off his suit, and cuddled it between his sheets, naked. Let him find me. I'll deal with it, one way or another. I recognized the feel of the bed, my bed. But the smell of him was all around me, wholesome and forgiving, like the strange scent which had suddenly come over my entire body when an elderly man who happened to be standing right next to me in the temple at Yom Kippur placed his talus over my head till I had all but disappeared and was now united with a nation that is forever dispersed but which, from time to time, comes together again when one being and another wrap themselves under the same piece of cloth. I put his pillow over my face, kissed it savagely, and wrapping my legs around it, told it what I lacked the courage to tell everyone else in the world. Then I told him what I wanted. It took less than a minute. The secret was out of my body. So what if he saw? So what if he caught me? So what? So what? So what? On my way to his room from mine, I wondered if I'd ever be mad enough to try the same thing again. That evening, I caught myself keeping careful tabs on where everyone was in the house. The shameful urge was upon me sooner than I'd ever imagined. It would have taken nothing to sneak back upstairs. While reading in my father's library one evening, I came upon the story of a handsome young knight who is madly in love with a princess. She, too, is in love with him, though she seems not to be entirely aware of it, and despite the friendship that blossoms between them, or perhaps because of that very friendship, he finds himself so humbled and speechless owing to her forbidding candor that he is totally unable to bring up the subject of his love. One day he asks her point blank, "Is it better to speak or die?" I'd never even have the courage to ask such a question. But what I'd spoken into his pillow revealed to me that, at least for a moment, I'd rehearsed the truth, gotten it out into the open, that I had in fact enjoyed speaking it. And if he happened to pass by at the very moment I was muttering things I wouldn't have dared speak to my own face in the mirror, I wouldn't have cared. Wouldn't have minded. Let him know. Let him see. Let him pass judgment, too, if he wants. Just don't tell the world. Even if you're the world for me right now. Even if in your eyes stands a horrified, scornful world. That steely look of yours, Oliver. I'd rather die than face it once I've told you. Part 2. Monet's Berm. Toward the end of July, things finally came to a head. It seemed clear that after Chiara, there had been a succession of cote, crushes, mini-crushes, one-night crushes, flings, who knows. To me, it boiled down to one thing only. His cock had been everywhere in B. Every girl had touched it, that cock of his. It had been in who knows how many vaginas, how many mouths. The image amused me. It never bothered me to think of him between a girl's legs as she lay facing him, his broad, tanned, glistening shoulders moving up and down as I had imagined him that afternoon when I, too, had wrapped my legs around his pillow. Just looking at his shoulders when he happened to be going over his manuscript in his heaven made me wonder where they'd been last night, how effortless and free the movement of his shoulder blades each time he shifted, How thoughtlessly they caught the sun. Did they taste of the sea to the woman who'd lain under him last night and bitten into him? Or of his suntan lotion? Or of the smell that had risen from his sheets when I went into them? How I wished I had shoulders like his. Maybe I wouldn't long for them if I had them. Movie star. Did I want to be like him? Did I want to be him? Or did I just want to have him? Or are being and having thoroughly inaccurate verbs in the twisted skein of desire, where having someone's body to touch and being that someone we're longing to touch are one and the same? Just opposite banks on a river that passes from us to them, back to us and over to them again in this perpetual circuit where the chambers of the heart, like the trapdoors of desire, and the wormholes of time, and the false bottom drawer we call identity, share a beguiling logic according to which is the shortest distance between real life and the life unlived. Between who we are and what we want is a twisted staircase designed with the impish cruelty of M.C. Escher. When had they separated us, you and me, Oliver? And why did I know it? And why didn't you? Is it your body that I want when I think of lying next to it every night, or do I want to slip into it and own it as if it were my own? As I did when I put on your bathing suit and took it off again, all the while craving, as I craved nothing more in my life that afternoon, to feel you slip inside of me as if my entire body were your bathing suit, your home, you and me in you. Then came the day. We were in the garden. I told him of the novella I had just finished reading. About the knight who doesn't know whether to speak or die. You told me already. Obviously, I'd mentioned it and forgotten. Yes. Well, does he, or doesn't he? Better to speak, she said. But she's on her guard. She senses a trap somewhere. So does he speak? No. He fudges. Figures. It was just after breakfast. Neither of us felt like working that day. Listen, I need to pick up something in town. Something was always the latest pages from the translator. I'll go, if you want me to. He sat silently a moment. No. Let's go together. Now? What I might have meant was, really? Why, have you got anything better to do? No. So let's go. He put some pages in the frayed green backpack and slung it over his shoulders. Since our last bike ride to B, he had never asked me to go anywhere with him. I put down my fountain pen, closed my scorebook, placed a half-full glass of lemonade on top of my pages, and was ready to go. On our way to the shed, we passed the garage. As usual, Manfredi, Mafalda's husband, was arguing with Anchise. This time he was accusing him of dousing the tomatoes with too much water, and that it was all wrong because they were growing too fast. "They'll be mealy," he complained. "Listen, I do the tomatoes, you do the driving, and we're all happy." "No, you don't understand. In my day, you move the tomatoes at some point, from one place to another. From one place to another, huh?" he insisted. "And you planted basil nearby, but of course you people who've been in the army know everything." "Ma, that's right." And Kise was ignoring him. "Of course I'm right. No wonder they didn't keep you in the army." "That's right, they didn't keep me in the army, huh?" Both of them greeted us. The gardener handed Oliver his bicycle. "I straightened the wheel last night. It took some doing. I also put some air in the tires." Manfredi couldn't have been more peeved. "From now on, I fix the wheels, you grow the tomatoes," said the peaked driver. And Kise gave a wry smile. Oliver smiled back. Once we reached the cypress lane that led to the main road in town, I asked Oliver, "Does he give you the creeps?" "Who?" "And Kise." "No. Why?" "I fell the other day on my way back and scraped myself pretty badly, and Kise insisted on applying some sort of witch's brew. He also fixed the bike for me." With one hand on the handlebar, he lifted his shirt and exposed a huge scrape and bruise on his left hip. "Still gives me the creeps," I said, repeating my aunt's verdict. "Just a lost soul, really." I would have touched, caressed, worshipped that scrape. On our way, I noticed that Oliver was taking his time. He wasn't in his usual rush. No speeding, no scaling the hill with his usual athletic zeal. Nor did he seem to be in a rush to go back to his paperwork, or join his friends on the beach, or, as was usually the case, ditch me. Perhaps he had nothing better to do. This was my moment in heaven. And young as I was, I knew it wouldn't last and that I should at least enjoy it for what it was, rather than ruin it with my oft-cranked resolution to firm up our friendship or take it to another plane. There'll never be a friendship, I thought. This is nothing, just a minute of grace. Zwischen ihm und nie, zwischen ihm und nie. Between always and never. Ceylon. When we arrived at the Piazzetta, overlooking the sea, Oliver stopped to buy cigarettes. He'd started smoking Galois. I'd never tried Galois and asked if I could. He took out a Cerino from the box, cupped his hands very near to my face, and lit my cigarette. Not bad, right? Not bad at all. They reminded me of him, of this day, I thought, realizing that in less than a month he'd be totally gone, without a trace. This was probably the first time I allowed myself to count down his remaining days in B. Just take a look at this, he said as we ambled with our bikes in the mid-morning sun towards the edge of the Piazzetta overlooking the rolling hills below. Farther out and way below was a magnificent view of the sea with scarcely a few stripes of foam streaking the bay like giant dolphins breaking the surf. A tiny bus was working its way uphill, while three uniformed bikers straggled behind it, obviously complaining of the fumes. You do know who's said to have drowned near here, he said. Shelley. And do you know what his wife, Mary, and friends did when they found his body? Cor cordium. Heart of hearts, I replied, referring to the moment when a friend had seized Shelley's heart before the flames had totally engulfed his swollen body as it was being cremated on the shore. Why was he quizzing me? Is there anything you don't know? I looked at him. This was my moment. I could seize it, or I could lose it, but either way I knew I would never live it down. Or I could gloat over his compliment, but live to regret everything else. This was probably the first time in my life that I spoke to an adult without planning some of what I was going to say. I was too nervous to plan anything. I know nothing, Oliver. Nothing. Just nothing. You know more than anyone around here. Why was he returning my near-tragic tone with bland ego-boosting? If you only knew how little I know about the things that really matter. I was treading water, trying neither to drown nor to swim to safety. Just staying in place, because here was the truth. Even if I couldn't speak the truth, or even hint at it, yet I could swear it lay around us. The way we say of a necklace we've just lost while swimming. I know it's down there somewhere. If he knew, if he only knew that I was giving him every chance to put two and two together and come up with a bigger number than infinity. But if he understood, then he must have suspected. And if he suspected, he would have been there himself, watching me from across a parallel lane with his steely, hostile, glass-eyed, trenchant, all-knowing gaze. He must have hit on something, though God knows what. Perhaps he was trying not to seem taken aback. What things that matter? Was he being disingenuous? You know what things. By now you of all people should know. Silence. Why are you telling me all this? Because I thought you should know. Because you thought I should know. He repeated my words slowly, trying to take in their full meaning, all the while sorting them out, playing for time by repeating the words. The iron, I knew, was burning hot. Because I want you to know, I blurted out. Because there is no one else I can say it to but you. There, I'd said it. Was I making any sense? I was about to interrupt and sidetrack the conversation by saying something about the sea and the weather tomorrow and whether it might be a good idea to sail out to E, as my father kept promising this time every year. But to his credit, he didn't let me loose. Do you know what you're saying? This time I looked out to the sea and, with a vague and weary tone that was my last diversion, my last cover, my last getaway, said, Yes, I know what I'm saying, and you're not mistaking any of it. I'm just not very good at speaking. But you're welcome never to speak to me again. Wait. Are you saying what I think you're saying? Yes. Now that I'd spilled the beans, I could take on the laid-back, mildly exasperated air with which a felon, who surrendered to the police, confesses yet once more to yet one more police officer how he robbed the store. Wait for me here. I have to run upstairs and get some papers. Don't go away. I looked at him with a confiding smile. You know very well I'm not going anywhere. If that's not another admission, then what is? I thought. As I waited, I took both our bikes and walked them toward the war memorial dedicated to the youth of the town who'd perished in the Battle of Piave during the First World War. Every small town in Italy has a similar memorial. Two small buses had just stopped nearby and were unloading passengers. Older women arriving from the adjoining villages to shop in town. Around the small piazza, the old folk, men mostly, sat on small, rickety, straw-backed chairs or on park benches wearing drab, old, dun-colored suits. I wondered how many people here still remembered the young men they'd lost on the Piave River. You'd have to be at least 80 years old today to have known them. And at least 100, if not more, to have been older than they were then. At 100, surely you learn to overcome loss and grief, or do they hound you till the bitter end? At 100, siblings forget, sons forget, loved ones forget, no one remembers anything. Even the most devastated forget to remember. Mothers and fathers have long since died. Does anyone remember? A thought raced through my mind. Would my descendants know what was spoken on this very piazzetta today? Would anyone? Or would it dissolve into thin air, as I found part of me wishing it would? Would they know how close to the brink their fate stood on this day, on this piazzetta? The thought amused me and gave me the necessary distance to face the remainder of this day. In 30, 40 years, I'll come back here and think back on a conversation I knew I'd never forget, much as I might want to someday. I'd come here with my wife, my children, show them the sights, point to the bay, the local cafes, Le Danzig, the Grand Hotel. Then I'd stand here and ask the statue and the straw-backed chairs and shaky wooden tables to remind me of someone called Oliver. When he returned, the first thing he blurted out was, "That idiot Milani mixed the pages and has to retype the whole thing. So I have nothing to work on this afternoon." Which sets me back a whole day. It was his turn to look for excuses to dodge the subject. I could easily have let him off the hook if he wanted. We could talk about the sea, the Piave, or fragments of Heraclitus, such as "Nature loves to hide," or "I went in search of myself." And if not these, there was the trip to E we'd been discussing for days now. There was also the chamber music ensemble due to arrive any day. On our way, we passed a shop where my mother always ordered flowers. As a child, I liked to watch the large storefront window awash in a perpetual curtain of water which came sliding down ever so gently, giving the shop an enchanted, mysterious aura that reminded me of how in many films the screen would blur to announce that a flashback was about to occur. "I wish I hadn't spoken," I finally said. I knew as soon as I'd said it that I'd broken the exiguous spell between us. "I'm going to pretend you never did." Well, that was an approach I'd never expected from a man who was so okay with the world. I'd never heard such a sentence used in our house. "Does this mean we're on speaking terms? But not really?" He thought about it. "Look, we can't talk about such things. We really can't." He slung his bag around him, and we were off downhill. 15 minutes ago, I was in total agony. Every nerve ending, every emotion bruised, trampled, crushed as in Mafalda's mortar. All of it pulverized till you couldn't tell fear from anger from the merest trickle of desire. But at that time, there was something to look forward to. Now that we had laid our cards on the table, the secrecy, the shame were gone, but with them so was that dash of unspoken hope that had kept everything alive these weeks. Only the scenery and the weather could buoy my spirits now, as would the ride together on the empty country road, which was entirely ours at this time of the day and where the sun started pounding exposed patches along the route. I told him to follow me. I'd show him a spot most tourists and strangers had never seen. "If you have time," I added, not wishing to be pushy this time. "I have time." It was spoken with a noncommittal lilt in his voice, as though he had found the overplayed tact in my words slightly comical. But perhaps this was a small concession to make up for not discussing the matter at hand. We veered off the main road and headed towards the edge of the cliff. "This," I said by way of a preface meant to keep his interest alive, "is the spot where Monet came to paint." Tiny stunted palm trees and gnarled olive trees studded the copse. Then, through the trees, on an incline leading toward the very edge of the cliff, was a knoll partly shaded by tall marine pines. I leaned my bike against one of the trees. He did the same, and I showed him the way up to the berm. "Now take a look," I said, extremely pleased, as if revealing something more eloquent than anything I might say in my favor. A soundless, quiet cove stood straight below us. Not a sign of civilization anywhere. No home, no jetty, no fishing boats. Farther out, as always, was the belfry of San Giacomo. And if you strained your eyes, the outline of N. And farther still was something that looked like our house and the adjoining villas, the one where Vimini lived, and the Moreschi family, with their two daughters, whom Oliver had probably slept with, alone or together, who knew, who cared at this point. "This is my spot. All mine. I come here to read. I can't tell you the number of books I've read here." "Do you like being alone?" he asked. "No. No one likes being alone. But I've learned how to live with it." "Are you always so very wise?" he asked. Was he about to adopt a condescending pre-lecture tone before joining everyone else on my needing to get out more, make more friends, and, having made friends, not be so selfish with them? Or was this a preamble to his role as shrink slash part-time friend of the family? Or was I yet again misreading him completely? "I'm not wise at all. I told you I know nothing. I know books, and I know how to string words together. It doesn't mean I know how to speak about the things that matter most to me." "But you're doing it now. In a way." "Yes. In a way. That's how I always say things. In a way." Staring out at the offing so as not to look at him, I sat down on the grass and noticed he was crouching a few yards away from me on the tips of his toes, as though he would any moment now spring to his feet and go back to where we'd left our bicycles. It never occurred to me that I had brought him here not just to show him my little world, but to ask my little world to let him in, so that the place where I came to be alone on summer afternoons would get to know him, judge him, see if he fitted in, take him in so that I might come back here and remember. Here I would come to escape the known world and seek another of my own invention. I was basically introducing him to my launch pad. All I had to do was list the works I'd read here, and he'd know all the places I'd traveled to. "I like the way you say things. Why are you always putting yourself down?" I shrugged my shoulders. Was he criticizing me for criticizing myself? "I don't know. So you won't, I suppose? Are you so scared of what others think?" I shook my head, but I didn't know the answer. Or perhaps the answer was so obvious that I didn't have to answer. It was moments such as these that left me feeling so vulnerable, so naked. "Push me. Make me nervous. And unless I push you back, you've already found me out." No, I had nothing to say in reply. But I wasn't moving either. My impulse was to let him ride home by himself. I'd be home in time for lunch. He was waiting for me to say something. He was staring at me. This, I think, is the first time I dared myself to stare back at him. Usually I'd cast a glance and then look away. Look away because I didn't want to swim in the lovely, clear pools of his eyes unless I'd been invited to. And I never waited long enough to know whether I was even wanted there. Look away because I was too scared to stare anyone back. Look away because I didn't want to give anything away. Look away because I couldn't acknowledge how much he mattered. Look away because that steely gaze of his reminded me of how tall he stood and how far below him I ranked. Now, in the silence of the moment, I stared back, not to defy him or to show him I wasn't shy any longer, but to surrender, to tell him this is who I am. This is who you are. This is what I want. There is nothing but truth between us now. And where there's truth, there are no barriers, no shifty glances, and if nothing comes of this, let it never be said that either of us was unaware of what might happen. I hadn't a hope left. And maybe I stared back because there wasn't anything to lose now. I stared back with the all-knowing, I dare you to kiss me, gaze of someone who both challenges and flees with one and the same gesture. You're making things very difficult for me. Was he by any chance referring to our staring? I didn't back down. Neither did he. Yes, he was referring to our staring. Why am I making things difficult? My heart was beating too fast for me to speak coherently. I wasn't even ashamed of showing how flushed I was. So let him know. Let him. Because it would be very wrong. Would? I asked. Was there a ray of hope then? He sat down on the grass, then lay down on his back, his arms under his head as he stared at the sky. Yes. Would. I'm not going to pretend this hasn't crossed my mind. I'd be the last to know. Well, it has. There. What did you think was going on? Going on? I fumbled by way of a question. Nothing. I thought about it some more. Nothing, I repeated. As if what I was vaguely beginning to get a hint of was so amorphous that it could just as easily be shoved away by my repeated nothing, and thereby fill the unbearable gaps of silence. Nothing. I see, he finally said. You've got it wrong, my friend. Chiding condescension in his voice. If it makes you feel any better, I have to hold back. It's time you learned, too. The best I can do is pretend I don't care. That much we've known for a while already. He snapped right away. I was crushed. All these times when I thought I was sliding him by showing how easy it was to ignore him in the garden, on the balcony, at the beach, he'd been seeing right through me and taken my move for the peevish textbook gambit it was. His admission, which seemed to open up all the sluiceways between us, was precisely what drowned my budding hopes. Where would we go from here? What was there to add? And what would happen the next time we pretended not to speak but were no longer sure the frost between us was still sham? We spoke a while longer, then our conversation petered out. Now that we'd put our cards on the table, it felt like small talk. So this is where Monet came to paint. I'll show you at home. We have a book with wonderful reproductions of the area around here. Yes, you have to show me. He was playing the role of the patronizing understudy. I hated it. Each leaning on one arm, we both stared out at the view. You're the luckiest kid in the world, he said. You don't know the half of it. I let him ponder my statement. Then, perhaps to fill the silence that was becoming unbearable, I blurted out, so much of it is wrong, though. What? Your family? That, too. Living here all summer long, reading by yourself, meeting all those dinner drudges your father dredges up at every meal. He was making fun of me again. I smirked. No, that wasn't it either. He paused a moment. Us, you mean? I did not reply. Let's see, then. And before I knew it, he sidled up to me. We were too close, I thought. I'd never been so close to him, except in a dream or when he cupped his hand to light my cigarette. If he brought his ear any closer, he'd hear my heart. I'd seen it written in novels, but never believed it until now. He stared me right in the face, as though he liked my face and wished to study it and to linger on it. Then he touched my nether lip with his finger and let it travel left and right and left again and again as I lay there, watching him smile in a way that made me fear anything might happen now, and there's no turning back, that this was his way of asking, and here was my chance to say no or to say something and play for time so that I might still debate the matter with myself, now that it had reached this point. Except I didn't have any time left, because he brought his lips to my mouth, a warm, conciliatory, I'll meet you halfway but no further kiss, till he realized how famished mine was. I wish I knew how to calibrate my kiss the way he did, but passion allows us to hide more, and at that moment on Monet's berm, if I wished to hide everything about me in this kiss, I was also desperate to forget the kiss by losing myself in it. "Better now?" he asked afterward. I did not answer, but lifted my face to his and kissed him again, almost savagely, not because I was filled with passion, or even because his kiss still lacked the zeal I was looking for, but because I was not so sure our kiss had convinced me of anything about myself. I was not even sure I had enjoyed it as much as I'd expected and needed to test it again. So that even in the act itself, I needed to test the test. My mind was drifting to the most mundane things. So much denial, a two-bit disciple of Freud would have observed. I squelched my doubts with a yet more violent kiss. I did not want passion. I did not want pleasure. Perhaps I didn't even want proof. And I did not want words, small talk, big talk, bike talk, book talk, any of it. Just the sun, the grass, the occasional sea breeze, and the smell of his body fresh from his chest, from his neck and his armpits. Just take me and molt me, turn me inside out, till, like a character in Ovid, I become one with your lust. That's what I wanted. Give me a blindfold, hold my hand, and don't ask me to think. Will you do that for me? I did not know where all this was leading, but I was surrendering to him, inch by inch, and he must have known it, for I sensed he was still keeping a distance between us. Even with our faces touching, our bodies were angles apart. I knew that anything I did now, any movement I'd make, might disturb the harmony of the moment. So, sensing there was probably not going to be a sequel to our kiss, I began to test the eventual separation of our mouths, only to realize, now that I was making mere motions of ending the kiss, how much I'd wanted it not to stop. Wanted his tongue in my mouth, and mine in his, because all we had become, after all these weeks and all the strife and all the fits and starts that ushered a chill draft each time, was just two wet tongues flailing away in each other's mouths. Just two tongues. All the rest was nothing. When, finally, I lifted one knee and moved it toward him, to face him, I knew I'd broken the spell. I think we should go. Not yet. We can't do this. I know myself. So far, we've behaved. We've been good. Neither of us have done anything to feel ashamed of. Let's keep it that way. I want to be good. Don't be. I don't care. Who's to know? In a desperate move which I knew I'd never live down if he did not relent, I reached for him and let my hand rest on his crotch. He did not move. I should have slipped my hand straight into his shorts. He must have read my intention, and with total composure, bordering on a gesture that was very gentle but also quite glacial, brought his hand there and let it rest on mine for a second, then, twining his fingers into mine, lifted my hand.